Well, this is Epistles of Paul. We are beginning our study on the book of Romans. We've been looking at a lot of background information to kind of get us settled into that atmosphere of first century Rome and what it would have been like to be in the Roman Empire. We talked about a number of things that made it possible for the gospel to be preached throughout the Roman Empire, for the Apostle Paul to travel because of the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, and the Roman roads, all of those various aspects that led to the possibility of the gospel to be preached. So amazing to see how God worked through this whole system in order for that gospel message to go out. So in thinking about the Roman Empire, of course, one of their key traits was as they developed, they spread, and they conquered various peoples. And so the road system grew larger. And of course, that whole idea of imperial Rome and the conquest that they had became very critical for Roman society. They could preach about their greatness and how wonderful they were and how powerful they were, right? And kind of brag about that. Well, oftentimes that took, I think, a special place in Roman society because it led to some of the monuments that were created throughout Rome. And one of the most notable are the triumphal arches that you can find throughout the city of Rome and actually around Rome, the Roman Empire itself, throughout Italy even today. Oftentimes they were placed on the main entrances to the city. You know, so if you were going to follow the Cardus, you might come right to one of the arches that usually commemorated a battle or a great victory. This particular picture is a photograph of the Arch of Titus. The Arch of Titus, it commemorated Titus' great victory. And do you know where that victory was? In Judea. Titus was the one that led the battle to conquer Jerusalem. And so Titus is responsible, basically, for the destruction of the temple. So in 70 AD is when that happened, a little bit before or a little bit after the book of Romans was written. But Titus was the one that was credited as the leading general in the conquest of Jerusalem and Judea, coming back to Rome. And in fact, on this particular arch, if you go and visit it today, you can see a depiction of carrying some of the Jews back to Rome. We talked before about triumphal parades that were held in the city. Well, they did that with the Jews that they conquered from Jerusalem, brought them back to Rome, paraded them through the cities. Oftentimes, after the end of the parade, they'd kill those captives. And this particular arch on the inside depicts some of the treasures that they brought back. So you can actually see some of the treasures of the temple itself. You can see one of the menorahs, the candlesticks, that they're parading through Rome. You can see one of the altars, probably it could have been the altar of showbread that they were praying. You can see the silver trumpets are portrayed inside in that one area of the Arch of Titus. And it does seem that because of all the treasure that they brought back, of course, think of some of the most important treasure. You've got the Ark, right? The Ark of the Testimony, right? The mercy seat, all lined with what? Gold. Gold. They brought back the treasures to Rome. And some of the historians will actually attribute the financing of the Colosseum to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, that they brought back the treasures and then had the funds to be able to build the Colosseum. So it seems that that might have been a contributing factor to the Colosseum actually being built. So in this particular triumphal arch, the Arch of Titus, you can actually see that displayed, which is very cool. If you ever get to go to Rome, you got to go see this. It's actually right next to the Colosseum. And so it's really easy to stop by there and see this Arch of Titus. And so they're commemorating great victories. They started out as wood, but then finally developed into these, you know, beautiful monuments with inscriptions or depictions, like I mentioned, this depiction of the conquest of Jerusalem. And so you'll find these throughout the city of Rome. There's a big arch to Constantine there, which was built much later, and those types of. And so it portrays this greatness that we are, you know, supreme, that we are the best, that we can conquer anybody. Kind of gives that impression. Of course, that some of that is to support the citizens to you know, keep that attitude and that perspective on who they were. So these arches were certainly a part of that imperial viewpoint. Okay, now let's take a couple minutes just to think about what it would have been like to live in Rome. Can you imagine what it would have been like? Now, Rome at the time had a pretty good-sized population. You know how many people lived in Rome during this first century time? Well, it's about three times bigger than the city of Cincinnati in the first century. So at least 1 million people lived in Rome. Cincinnati proper is only a little over 300,000. And so, huge city, a huge city. But imagine a city without running water. Imagine a city without a real intricate sewage system. Imagine a city where you have to bring all of your food in and basically no refrigeration. What would that have been like? Rome was pretty dirty, pretty difficult. It wouldn't have been a fun place to live. Most of the citizens in Rome would have probably lived in buildings like you see in this particular slide. Insulae is what they call these buildings. And on the bottom floor, there was normally little shops and, you know, marketplaces, that sort of thing, on the lower level. And then buildings were normally multi-story, not very high, though, because the way the construction was, it wasn't that reliable. So usually four stories, maybe in an occasional six-story building, but that would have been about it, not a high-rise apartment building. But most people lived in apartment buildings, insulae, that would have looked something like this. They would have been kind of a rental housing, you could say. That would be for those that were in the city. The urban poor would have certainly lived there. Some of the artisans would have lived in places like this, mainly built of brick and wood, some concrete. And also what you'd recognize in these apartments. What do you think was the status of those that lived on the lower levels compared to the upper levels? That upper level is not a penthouse like you might think of a big high-rise or something like that. The higher you went, the lower class you probably were. Would have been more difficult to live on those higher levels because all the smoke would have been rising. They didn't have any electricity, so they had to burn oil lamps, probably olive oil lamps. Where do you think all that went? Right up to the upper levels? That would have been the worst place to live. So the lower levels would have certainly been the ones that would have been more desirable. And of course, think, you got to carry water up there if you're going to have any water at all. Isn't it fun to walk up a bunch of stairs? No, who wants to do that? Or if you've got to go to the bathroom. You know, there wasn't private sanitation. So it would have been a very difficult thing. You had to go to a public water fountain to get water. You'd have to go to a public latrine in order to use the bathroom. And so, yeah, really difficult lifestyle. And people were jammed in the city. And so just imagine what it might have looked like and what it would have smelled like. Yeah, pretty rough. But it wasn't that way forever. But that's the majority of the people. The majority of the people, we're probably talking about 50% of the population would have lived like this. Maybe even more would have been living in this type of a situation. Now, others lived in domiciles. Now, that's a private home. A private home, still normally within the city in that sense, but guess who would have lived here? The wealthy people. The wealthy people would have lived here. And so they would have been those equestrians, or the equites would have been the wealthy ones that would have lived here. Those would have been the important people that had more important jobs. And they were very well laid out. So they usually had areas where people could socialize, atriums, gardens, even within the domus, which would have been interesting. And so very nice. There would have been special rooms as well, like special bedrooms and special dining rooms and offices within the domus. And it would have been decorated, so nothing like an apartment, right? Nothing like an insulae. So there would have been artwork with mosaics and frescoes, and there would have been, you know, possibly fountains, because, you know, these were wealthy people, and it would have reflected their status in that regard. And so you can see that would have been a much more enjoyable place to live than in an insulae in an apartment. But then you could even step it up from there. From there, if you were really at the top, you might live in a villa. And this is just a little diagram of what a villa would have looked like. Now, a villa would have been like a country estate. So this would have been a big place. This would have been owned by the wealthiest of the Romans. And they wouldn't have been city urban housing. Nope, not at all. They would have been along the countryside, or they'd be in a scenic area, or on the coast, those types of things. And so you could think of these as oftentimes working farms. Farmland would have surrounded a villa. Yes, it was a residence for the bigwigs, but it could have been a farming type situation. Or if you were really rich, it could just be a luxury retreat, right? So these villas were pretty amazing. Normally the, what did they call it? The Villa Rustica were the agricultural estates, and the others, the Villa Urbana would have been, oh, it's my country home. How about that? So what an amazing thing to be able to, you know, live in the villa. Of course, it meant you were at the top of the scale. The senators or the senatores would have been the ones that would probably own villas, maybe even more than one. But we're talking about a very small percentage of the population. The senators, what were they? They were the top political people, the top leaders. They would have been the governors of major provinces. They would have been the lawmakers. So senators would have villas that they lived in. They basically had the highest power, other than the emperor himself. Yes, the senators had power, and they were the ruling elite. So imagine being a part of that group, ruling the Roman Empire, not just Rome itself, but the empire itself as well. So how many are we talking about that would have been at that upper echelon in the senators, in that social class? Well, first century, maybe 1,000 people. That's it. Really, really tiny, but yet we're the wealthiest and politically the most powerful as well. We had talked about the equestrians, another social class. They're just a step down from the senators, the equestrians or the equites. Interesting history for the equestrians, because they got that name from long ago. That was part of the army, were the equestrians, you know, the cavalry, we'd call them today. They were the cavalry, and eventually were the ones that were awarded lands and, you know, important responsibility. Well, eventually it comes to be this social class that is very wealthy. They're the administrators. They're the ones that are the military officers. They would have been the tax collectors, the bankers, the financiers. That would have been the equestrian class. So they're upper class as well. Below the senators, but very influential. And oftentimes they were managing the government, the what we call today, the bureaucracy. That would have been then. them. So another class, quite a bit bigger than the senatorial class. Here we're looking at maybe up to 20,000 people were in that class of the equestrians. And so very influential and powerful to a degree. Not as powerful as the senators, but still, compared to everybody else, wow, yeah, quite a difference there. Below the equestrians, maybe a familiar name, the plebes, or the plebeians. If you've been to college, you've heard of some of the things that, you know, the plebes, you're going to be in an organization, maybe you start at the bottom, right? Now, it wasn't necessarily that they're at the bottom, definitely below the equestrians, but they were free citizens. They were citizens of the Roman Empire, which is important. That's an important designation, to be a citizen. They would have been the artisans. They would have been the farmers. They would have been the soldiers. They would have been those that sold goods, merchants. And they had some power because they had a voice in the assemblies. Not the highest social prestige in that regard, but at least there was something there that they could vote in those assemblies. And so you could see that, okay, there's something to their influence in that regard. And of course, we're talking about a much bigger class. Something like 400,000 would have been plebeians during this time in first century Rome. That's a pretty good size of the population. Almost up to half of the city of Rome would have been plebes in that regard. Now, moving down the scale, there was also a social class that was known as the liberti, or liberty. Well, it's kind of, yeah, it kind of connects to who they were. If you have liberty, what do you have? Freedom. Freedom. So these are the freedmen, the freedmen. Well, who are the freedmen? Well, you can think of captives and freedmen, and you'd be thinking along the right lines. The freedmen were former slaves. They were former slaves who were granted freedom. And so when we recognize that, they're not necessarily citizens. They didn't necessarily, and most oftentimes didn't have Roman citizenship because they had been slaves. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't do certain tasks. I mean, oftentimes they were very skilled workers. They were business people, sometimes even lawyers. Oftentimes would serve the other classes, serve the equestrians or serve the senators. And so you could see, yeah, they were socially limited, but there was a way to improve, you know, that their wealth could actually increase. And so they didn't really have any direct authority or power or influence in that way. Any they might have had would have been more indirect. Not a real big social class either. Here we're looking at maybe in Rome, 100,000 people were freedmen. But we'll recognize throughout Paul's writings, he oftentimes will refer or intimate this class of people as freedmen. We'll see how some of these references will show up as we actually dig into the scripture and recognize some of those connections. Okay, as we move down the scale, we've got two other classes left. Below the freedmen would have been those that weren't freedmen. So that's the slaves. The slaves would have been next. Slaves were property. That's what they were. They belonged to their owner. No legal rights. We'll run into that in great detail when we study the book of Philemon in Epistles of Paul. Sometimes they had halfway decent jobs. If you were a house slave, you were doing okay. A house slave would be a good job to have if that was what you were doing as a slave. So kind of as a domestic servant. Others were laborers, which would have been much more difficult. If you were a miner, not a good job. they were the worst, because you have to go into the mines where it's dirty and dusty. Your lifespan is probably not going to be real long. Other slaves were also gladiators. Sometimes the slaves were used as gladiators as well. So interesting to think about that class of people that served the wealthy. Now, at times, a slave had a potential to be free. Sometimes slaves, if their owners would allow them, could volunteer for the military. And if they performed some great military feat, you know, if they helped defeat the enemy, or, you know, if they were to, like we might think today, win the Medal of Honor, did something, you know, amazing in battle, contributed to Rome in some, you know, important way, they might be granted freedom. And then they would become one of those liberty. They'd be one of those freedmen then. So that carrot was always kind of dangling out there before the slaves. Not often did it happen. And so it really was kind of more like a carrot in that regard. But you can get an idea that we have to keep these people at least under control in some way, happy to some level. And you know why? This was a huge group of people. Think of the population of Rome. Maybe up to 40% of the population were slaves. And yeah, throughout Roman history, there are times when there were slave revolts. And so they had to keep the slaves kind of placated. They had to keep them under control in that way, especially since they had, you know, they were property and had really no legal rights whatsoever. So you could kind of see how that could become an issue. Okay, one more class. What do you think was the lowest class on the Roman social scale? Well, wait a second, didn't we get them all? Women. Yeah, women on the low. They were citizens. I mean, you could be a citizen, but you couldn't hold political office. And so oftentimes that's, now it didn't mean some of the higher classes didn't have influence. Definitely that was the case. But more often than not, they were the ones that maybe managed the household. They had their families that they were taking care of. Maybe they were making alliances with other families, that sort of thing. The women had religious duties and responsibilities that they did. Their status, I mean, technically would have mirrored their husband. So if you were married to a plebe, well, you were a plebe. If you were married to an equestrian, you were an equestrian or senator. You would have basically mirrored that status as well, but still looked upon as, you know, the lowest on the scale. So kind of interesting to think of what that might be like. And especially when you consider what Paul writes about different classes of people, because he's going to address that. And so in what did it look like in God's eyes? You know, well, Paul has to address that. You know, do we have the same scale, social status when it comes to God's way of life? Okay, well, he has to address that. And we'll see that come up, you know, as we go through his writings. Also interesting to think, what would have been like to live in the Roman Empire? If you actually lived during this day, you think of all these various classes of people and think that the average person, if you weren't a slave, was a plebeian. Your life would have been centered around your family, your household. And the father, the male head, would have been the top dog, with his wife, the woman, kind of managing the household. Remember, most people would have lived in these insulae, in these apartment buildings, overcrowded, dirty, not much for privacy. Sanitation, ooh, not good. If you were upper, a little more upper class, you might have a single family home, a domus. Could even have a luxury like water, water that came through the building. That would have been pretty amazing. But if you worked, I mean, the average citizen, what did they do? Well, they had their trades. So they'd work in various trades, crafts, different merchants as well, but more labor-intensive type of jobs. So some would have been those workers that would have helped build the buildings in the various towns. And so when you think of being just an average person, if you were a slave, you probably worked on a farm. Maybe if you were fortunate, you worked in a home. Otherwise, even if you were free, you might have been a farm worker, agricultural worker. And it's interesting to think that how Rome's economy depended so much on imported goods. I'd mentioned earlier, if it hadn't been for conquering Egypt and the grain supplies that came from Egypt, they wouldn't have been able to feed the population at all. In fact, if you read through Roman history, it's very interesting, you know, what happened during this time period in various crises where, you know, people gained power and then it put the whole system, you know, on the verge of collapse in many ways because they just didn't have the food. I had mentioned earlier, you know, in daily life, a big social thing would have been the baths. That's where, after you work hard all day, you could go there for socializing and relaxation. That would have certainly been important. The entertainment, of course, that's where the spectacles come into play. The games, whether it be the gladiator games, the chariot races at the circus, going to the theater seeing a performance, all of those things were certainly, embedded into everyday life in Rome. And some of those things, the spectacles themselves, oftentimes put on for free. You could go to these spectacles because the emperor was going to sponsor this activity. Well, why would he do that? Just to spend big bucks to have, you know, entertainment? No. You want to placate the people. Placate the people. Are they going to rise up against 1,000 of the top dogs, the most wealthy? If, hey, I'm fine. You know, hey, I get to go to the games. This will be fun. This will be nice. And so they could placate the population through entertainment. Any connections to that today? Can we be placated and, right. I don't have to worry about anything because I'm okay, right? Interesting to think of those connections. Yeah, so they placated the people with the games. That's really what that was about. Those rituals, kind of festivities, all dedicated usually to the emperor or various gods, various of their pagan gods. So it's really interesting just to think of those connections. In one of the videos we saw, the demise of Rome was related to that very thing. You know, everybody's okay and lethargy and, we see those parallels with our society today. And so that everyday life, to try to overcome some of the challenges with the overcrowding, with the poor sanitation, which of course would have led to what? Outbreaks of disease, right? That would have been part of the problems, especially you get to the lower class neighborhoods. You don't want to lead there. Crime was a problem as well. And so they had kind of their own military police that would try to keep order. You've heard of a cohort. The cohortes urbana would have been what we'd think of the police department to try to help maintain order. Yeah, they were out throughout the neighborhoods. And so just thinking how challenging it would have been to live there, we find that Rome was certainly a mix of all kinds of things, from the upper classes that were wealthy and powerful to those that had to do the work and were forced to do the work and were slave labor. Considering those different things, it's interesting just to think of the Roman Empire has this amazing, vibrant culture on one side, but then on the other, just the dark side of things in the way that they had to work and just survive in that system. I might spend just a couple of moments looking at an important aspect of the citizens that Paul addresses fairly often through his writings. He certainly will as he writes to the Romans here, and that's addressing the slaves. You know, basically the lowest of the low, just barely above the women in that regard. But imagine the Roman Empire. Without slaves, it couldn't have operated, wouldn't have been successful. Throughout the empire, there were, at least at this time, first century, probably 10 million slaves throughout the Roman Empire. In Rome, first century, we're looking at maybe 400,000 in the city of Rome, but throughout the empire, millions, millions. Where did they come from? Many were captured in battle, so they could have came from any area, even as far away as Britain. They took slaves and brought them back. And so the slaves were absolutely important. A historian named Cicero even writes about where some of these slaves came from, and Britain was one of the examples that he used. And slaves could basically be anybody. It could be men, women, boys, girls, anybody. If a slave were to marry and have children, guess what? The children were slaves. They weren't owned by their parents. They were owned by their master. Now, in order to obtain a slave, how did a wealthy person get a slave? Well, you buy them. You buy them. You're wealthy. You buy them. So how did they do that? Well, they didn't go to Walmart. But they had slave markets, the slave trade. And so you could go to the marketplace, to the slave market, and buy a slave. So there was an intricate system of basically human trafficking, right? And so oftentimes, if you wanted to buy a slave, well, how much was it going to cost? That depends. If they could do some things, guess what? The price went up. You know, if they were talented, if they had a trade, you know, if they had a skill, what could you do for the master? Well, the more you could do, the higher the price went. So if you were skilled in any way, your price would be high. And you know, one of the highest things that they really looked at? If you could cook. You know, because if you're wealthy, you want the best. So if you were a good cook, that was something they oftentimes would look at. Of course, the other thing that would determine the cost of a slave, how old are you? How old are you? So if I was captured, oh boy, I'd go for nothing, right? But, you know, you're 18, 19, 20, you got your whole life ahead of you. You're going to be more valuable. So the value of a slave was based on the work you could do for your master. And the longer you could do it, guess what? The price went up. Makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, it makes sense. So interesting just to think about how this worked. And even looking at those different classes of people, you know, if you were a wealthy, if you were at the top, let's say you were a senator, you had a villa, you had farmland, you had every, how many slaves do you think someone like that might own? They could own something like 400 or 500 slaves. 400 or 500. Could you imagine that? Yeah, just absolutely. Well, no wonder Rome was so dependent on slave labor. They had to do the work. So life was generally, overall, hard. Imagine just being somebody's property. No rights. You have no say. Master could treat you nice, or he could just beat you. He could kill you. You know, you were totally dependent on your master's wishes. So, yeah, there's horrible examples of how slaves were just brutally treated. Others treated very nicely, very nicely. So it really just depended on your master and who was in charge of the slaves. And if you were a house slave, we had mentioned before that would have been okay. I mean, if you had to be a slave, house slave would be the best. You'd get up early in the morning. You know, you'd have to definitely get up before you know, the wealthy people, get up early. Before sunrise, normally the slaves would get up, and they had many jobs around the house they had to do. First one, well, you got to fire up the furnace if it's cold, right? The hypocaust, they call it. Basically, get the fires going because it's cold out here. You had to do that very first. If you were a household slave, you'd have to help dress the family. That would probably be one of your jobs. If they were in the baths, your job would be to get the towels ready and dry them off as they came out of the baths, right? You would have been the one that had to clean up, clean the villa, make sure everything's spick and span. You'd have to wash all the clothes. Some would be responsible for the daily meals. And it's interesting the way that some of these villas were arranged, even the domus, the domiciles, the way they were arranged, there were always false walls built in so that a slave could be unseen, standing behind like a partition, we might think of it. And as soon as the master needed something, they appear out of nowhere, and there they are to help. So it's really interesting just to think about the jobs they did and how they fulfilled those various functions. Now, if you were outside the house, that's really tough. If you were mining silver, lead, oh, that would be the worst. The lead mines, your life expectancy is going to be shrinking all the time. But they had gold mines, they had tin mines, silver mines that their masters owned. And, you know, they didn't have, you know, hydraulic equipment to get out the precious metal, right? They did it by hand. They had to do it by hand. So it was back-breaking work. It was just really, really difficult. They might go down in these mines, and it wasn't one of these things where, well, I'll go down to the mine, and I'll work today, and I'll come back up, and, you know, then I'll be able to get cleaned up and hang out. And no, it wasn't like that. Oftentimes, slaves would go down into the mines. They wouldn't see the sun for months. They were down there working. And so imagine that. Imagine staying in those. That was the life of many slaves throughout the empire. So you definitely would not want to have to be a miner if you were a slave. Now, if you had a skill, if you had a talent, you know, if you had a skill at math, maybe you could be an accountant, because some of the slaves had important jobs like accountants or teachers. Some of them did that. And then ultimately, many would have the ultimate goal in mind, and that would be to hopefully someday be set free. And that would be the ultimate. But imagine if you actually had to live as a slave. I mean, there was a slight possibility in the empire that you could buy your way out of slavery. Wow, that seems like a good deal, right? But wait a second, slaves don't earn money. So how are you going to buy your way out of slavery? Just not going to happen. Just not going to happen. And so what a terrible system, you know, to consider just the human resources, you know, that they forced upon those captives, oftentimes the most captives that they had taken from the different battles. Yeah, amazing in that regard. Now, when you think of that compared to being a citizen of the Roman Empire, what a vast difference. If you were a citizen of the Roman Empire, you were very blessed. There were many benefits. And of course, as we study the Apostle Paul's writings, guess what? He's a Roman citizen. He is a Roman citizen. And because of that, he has the rights of Roman citizenship. So if you were a Roman citizen, one of the most important things, you had legal benefits. You could have a fair trial. You were promised a fair trial and could actually appeal more often than not. We even see in Scripture, one of the benefits of being a Roman citizen is you were protected from torture. You couldn't torture a Roman citizen without a trial. And they couldn't execute you before a trial. And so that's an important thing. And Paul's going to claim those rights. In fact, later on, that's why he's going to end up in Rome. We'll see that as we study the pastoral epistles as he ends up in Rome, because he claims his legal rights. So that's an important thing. As a Roman citizen, you have legal rights. You also have economic rights. So we're talking about finances that way. What would be an economic right? As a citizen, you could own property. You could own property. You could pass property on to your offspring. So you could inherit property. Also meant that you could make contracts. You know, you could have free access to trade and the markets, which would have been very important. And you could marry. You could legally marry. And those were all those rights that tie into the financial side of Roman citizenship. We already talked about a couple of the other benefits of political rights. As a Roman citizen, you had political rights. Even the plebs could vote in the assemblies. That was a political right. Depending on your status, you could even hold public office. Now, you couldn't be a senator. No, you couldn't do that. But some of the lower assemblies, you could hold a public office, which would be at least more influence in that regard. And then, of course, as a citizen, you also had the social benefits. You had higher status, right? I'm not a freedman. I am a citizen of Rome. So with the legal protection and the rights, also then could participate in the religious aspects, the social aspects of religion within the empire as well. So that is certainly gives you opportunities, as well as just participating with things like the baths. Because I'm a citizen, I can go to the baths or the theaters or the circus or the games, all those types of things. So you had access to an infrastructure that wouldn't have been available to others. And then, of course, maybe the last benefit as a Roman citizen, you could pass that citizenship on to your children. And so there were rights of inheritance. That becomes very important. We're going to see that in Paul's writings, that he'll address an inheritance. Now, he's going to bring it to us from a religious perspective, from a godly perspective. We'll talk about inheritance. But Roman citizens would get that metaphor. They'd get that idea because of the benefits of being a citizen of the Roman Empire. So as you think about Roman citizenship and the benefits of Roman citizenship, certainly it provided that security in so many ways, legal, economic, political influence, all those different things, access to all those public services that the government provided, all of those things made it very valuable. It was so important to be a Roman citizen if you lived in the Roman Empire. And so as we study the book of Romans, we'll get into that more thoroughly as we look at some of the people that Paul writes to. We'll also see the example of Paul himself as a Roman citizen and the benefits that flow from that citizenship. He'll use that idea in metaphors throughout his writings as well. So we'll see some of those connections to a spiritual perspective as well. So a lot of different things that affect where he lived, when he lived, what the empire was like, will certainly impact us as we study the words that have been preserved for us. So we'll do that next time. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about the influence of the religious aspects of the Roman Empire when we come back next time. But then we'll hopefully dig into the letter itself. So we'll look forward to doing that next time.